Well, kia ora tātou koutou katoa. Good to see you all. For those that have not met me, I'm Joe Hollander. I'm Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust. And it is our pleasure, in conjunction with the City Library, to co-host these midday monthly military history presentations that we run throughout the course of the year. You'll appreciate that October is New Zealand Land Wars Month, and so what we've tried to do over the years is pick a particular topic that would be of interest to you. And our resident expert, Peter Wood, who's well known to most of you, is here today to talk to us a little bit about pork, potatoes and powder, the basis of the musket wars during the period of the early 1800s. We're very lucky to have Peter, who is the director of the New Zealand Land Wars Study Centre at the New Zealand Defence College, and is well experienced and qualified to speak to us today. So without further ado, Peter.
Right, kia ora everyone, and thanks for the introduction, Joe. This is a big topic. 30 years, some 3,000 battles, engagements and raids. There's a lot we could cover. And well, we've only got about 45 minutes or so you'll excuse me if I just slim it down a bit. There's something like 18 to 20,000 people were killed. We'll never know the numbers, but that's a big number anyway. Some dates, I've got up there 1807. Some people suggest near 1818, the start. Some say it was all over in 1837, and others, Danny Keenan for one, Ron Crosby for another, would say maybe it didn't end until 1845. So we won't argue over the dates, and we won't go into all the battles and engagements, but we'll just go through it. So the musket wars, as Joe pointed out, preceded the New Zealand wars, and they were a series of battles, engagements between different tribal groups of Māori, and they ranged, unlike the New Zealand wars, which were predominantly, solely really, in the North Island. These ranged the length and breadth of the two main islands of New Zealand, and even made it across to the Chatham. So they're significant for their duration, the geographic spread, and also for the numbers who were involved and impacted by it. I put pork, potatoes and powder up there, gunpowder, but arguably there's a fourth P, and that would be pakeha, because Europeans certainly provided the muskets, not to cause the war, but what did allow the wars to be prosecuted in the way that they were. Now, prior to the arrival of the musket and the other P's up there, intertribal warfare was pretty much hand-to-hand, or with very limited weapons like medi, patu, taiha. So it was face-to-face. It was almost like group combat, personal, and there was a lot of tikanga involved. And the arrival of musket, though, transformed the nature of warfare. So instead of it being face-to-face, smaller groups of warriors against others, it was suddenly conducted at much greater range, the length of range of the weapon, and also in far greater numbers, with the end result being much more casualties being inflicted. So it's significant. So in my job, I'm lucky enough to have a role where I take groups of military, including our civil staff, to some of the New Zealand Wars battle sites, and Saturday I'll be back up in New Plymouth, and when we go to New Plymouth I often take the group to Ngā Motu, which is basically where Port Taranaki is now, and not only is it the landing point of the settlers later on, but back in 1832, it was the site of a significant musket wars battle. Not much to see there now. Cars parked, port and there. But back in the day, this was a significant battle fought defending by the Te Atiawa tribes of New Plymouth, and it being attacked by Waikato tribes from the north. So I like the picture because it's one of the few that you can get that is in colour and describes an event in the Musket Wars. So, but I thought I'd use it this one because it just shows some of the features of the Musket Wars. So in the background, that's the Sugarloaf Island in the background. Defenders, many of the women and children and the older people were taken to the island and protected there, mostly by women actually holding off the Waikatos off the cliffs of the little island on the shore there with long sticks to keep the women and children safe. In the pā itself, that's more of a traditional type pā. You can see the palisading, but they've made a firing platform. Now what's unusual about that is the presence of Pākehā in it. It's very unusual for Pākehā to actually have been involved in musket war fighting, but in this case, Dickie Barrett, the guy with his arm up, he's a whaler. He and about several of his men are working with the local Te Atiawa whaling station, and they've got cannon for their own defence, which is now brought into the defence of this particular pā, so it plays some role. But on the firing platform, you'll see the defenders, the Te Atiawa, are fighting off the attackers with a range of traditional weapons and muskets, because at this stage there's still a high proportion of traditional weapons versus muskets. And you'll see the attackers are coming over the top, they too, some with muskets and others with traditional weapons, because even in a musket fight, when you get really close and you're fired, you're shot, you haven't got 20 seconds to reload, you're out there with your close-in weapons. The other thing I like about this one is down the bottom on the right is Ngāti Wahine Toa, is actually a woman who's involved in the fighting. Not sure if she was actually in the combat, but in many cases, women's role inside the pā would be to load and then pass up or pass over to the men the muskets. But presumably some got actually involved in the fighting itself. So what's happened there is Pukirangi Ora is a much larger Taranaki pā that's been besieged by the Waikatos for 3 months. And so the defenders down at Ngāmotu, some 15 kilometres away from Pukirangi Ora, have got a little bit of time to get themselves inside the pā and organise it for the defence, because they know they're going to be next once Pukirangi Ora falls, which it does. So the Waikatos appear at the pā with about 1,600 warriors, so this is a large war party now, many muskets, and they've descended on the pā where there's about 300 Te Atiawa, including the Pākehā, the few Pākehā there, and only about 100 muskets, but those four cannon which play a part. The pā is surrounded, and then in traditional, they try and pull down the palisades, they throw in the firebrands. Now they've got muskets, they start building towers so they can reach over and fire down into the pā. There's saps being dug. The Te Atiawas do a few charges out to try and get some of the Waikatos. So there's a real battle going on, and this lasts for about 3 weeks, including an attempt by the Waikatos to get to the women and children on the Sugarloaf, which is repulsed. Fortunately, all the attacks are repulsed. But by late February, the Waikatos are starting to run out of ammunition and supplies, food even, having consumed some of their slaves, I would add. But on the final attack on the 23rd of February, they're repulsed. Hundreds are left dead on the battlefield, and they panic, basically, and they retire. But this is what then drives the defenders of the pā now to leave the Taranaki and join the others of their Te Atiawa who are now down, who are already down in the Wellington region, because they want to escape the next wave of Waikatos, which are surely going to come to seek revenge for their defeat at Ngāmotu. So this sort of illustrates a lot of the dynamics that are going on inside the Musket Wars battle and this whole idea of Utu and the revenge that comes. at that. So I'll just go through basically that list there of things. What I want to do, though, is focus initially on Ngāpuhi, who were the first to get muskets and did the first raids, just briefly. We'll talk about also Ngāti Toa, who come out of the Kawhi area, and they pick up the Taranaki tribes, and we'll talk through about three or four of their battles, and then just talk about the impact that the wars had. The image there, Hetawa, Hetawa. So there's a war party coming. A war party is coming. This is alarm in the past. So there they are with their traditional weapons, having sighted a war party on the way to attack them. So there's a bit of a timeline there, and I acknowledge I've taken it from, adapted it from Ron Crosby's book, The Forgotten Wars. So you can see the different phases are there. And for the military in the audience, phases go one after the other. Please excuse the fact that some of these are simultaneously. It's just a great way to sort of picture how the wars unfolded. So in the first phase, this is when Ngāpuhi start to raid down into not just past the Auckland area, but all the way down and into towards Wellington. In the second phase, now the central iwi, including the Waikatos, which I've just talked about, they raid down into the Taranaki, and even across to the other side towards Hawke's Bay and the Bay of Plenty. In the third phase, Te Rauparaha, with his Ngāti Toa, they move down to Kawhia and establish themselves around Kapiti and conquer the Porowhenua area, and I'll talk about one little battle in that area. Then Ngāti Toa, in an alliance, crosses the Cook Strait and conquers the top half, if you like, of the South Island. And then in the fifth phase, there's Ngāitahu themselves from the lower half now of the South Island raid back up to the north. These are really long-range tawa or war parties that have been undertaken. And also Ngāti Tama and Ngāti Mutunga, who've previously come down from the Taranaki area to Wellington, now elect to go to the Chatham Islands to get away from the fighting that's going on there. And then finally, there's a couple of little battles towards the end, maybe as late as 1845. So just to have a look at this, and I apologise, it's a bit of a busy slide there, but anyway, basically, for muskets, trading currency becomes pork and potatoes, if you like, just to try to characterise it. Now, the quantities of pork and potatoes being traded for muskets is not now for the consumption of sailors and settlers. This is stuff that those traders are actually taking to Sydney and are selling over there. So it's become a tradable commodity, and we see a bit of a cycle going where to acquire more muskets, you need to plant and harvest more potatoes and get and more pigs. And to do that, you need more work people. So the dynamic within your iwi changes. So suddenly the work requires more people, and that can include getting people back as slaves. So you've kind of got this cycle being set up. But muskets really came into New Zealand up in Kororareka. It was close to the whalers, so lots of whaling ships would come in, and they traded muskets for basically food and stuff for themselves initially. Maori wanted them for hunting and stuff like that. But a number of other merchants came in, you know, and tools are being traded, so tools for gardening, but also tools that could be used for construction of power and defensive positions and things like that as well. So Ngāpuhi get them pretty much in quantity. We know about Hongihika going to England, meeting royalty there and coming back and bringing muskets. We know he was aided in this by the missionary Thomas Kendall, who himself did some trading. Cost him, I think, being a member of the church, but nevertheless he did. In fact, just the whole idea of a potato wars, I think that the naming of that was started by James Belich, who wrote a lot about the New Zealand wars, but wasn't a particularly good name for it, so I think they've stuck with the thing there. But certainly the trading in flax, potatoes and pork was as much part of it as the muskets. This guy, Te Pihi Kupe, he's a member of Ngāti Toa. He comes up again in the story, but he's Te Rauparaha's uncle. A trading ship has become becalmed off Kapiti Island, so he walks out to it, and then he climbs himself up and refuses to leave the ship. There's a bit of an argument there, but anyway, he makes it all the way to England. He too gets to meet the king. He also comes back to New Zealand via Sydney, trades up his gifts for muskets, and suddenly Ngāti Toa have an additional supply of muskets. So, you know, the musket wars, there's a lot of ingenuity. There's all these kind of stories that are involved in it. But, you know, the acquisition of muskets, and this was important for Ngāti Toa, they'd already been displaced from Kawhia down to the Kapiti region to get away from the Waikatos and the pressure there. Now they've got lots of muskets, which they can use when they've got a mind to. There were attempts to try and stem the musket and gunpowder trade. They come in a little bit too late, really, but nevertheless they did. And I should also add, though, that many of the tribes were really, especially the central and southern ones, it was almost an arms race. They needed to acquire muskets for their own defence more than anything else. So anyway, so started up north and swiftly moved south. So traditional warfare had, you know, Hokafetu, that's our suburb here in Palmerston North, that relates to a sort of a small taua or war party. Literally means 140, but really means just a smallish kind of war party. But you know, by 1822, Hongihika's leading 3,000 warriors there. So you can see the scale of the war parties. Women are sometimes involved. We've moved from close-in weapons to firearms, and Māori are very quick on the uptake about volley fire and all this sniping, all these kind of things. They work out for themselves and adapt this into their style of fighting. We see the evolution of the gunfighter power, which I'll cover in a second, and we see the shift of power to those tribes that have got muskets against those who don't. And in the first part, of course, many tribes actually don't have muskets. But what it means is larger war parties travelling longer distances, staying away from home for longer periods of time, but more casualties are being inflicted. So there's a massive scale-up in the fighting as opposed to the days of traditional warfare, where often combat was against neighbours or near neighbours, but not too far away. So the old pa on the hill, which we know and kind of recognise from the terracing that we still have in New Zealand, was essentially wooden palisades and concentric circles, you know, and as you got through one layer of the defence, the defenders would go back to the next layer, and score right that way, and you can see there a ditch dug on the outside, that sort of thing. But some of these pa have been around for hundreds of years, and they've got larger and larger and larger as the population grows. But actually, in the era of the musket, they can become death traps. So Māori quickly learn, and I appreciate this is actually a New Zealand Wars 1845 pa, but you can see we've gone from those circular hilltop or cliff edge in the side of a river. We're now talking about small rectangular or square type low down. Now you're behind a palisade, but probably in a trench, either kneeling or standing, so you've got your protection and your musket is pointing out through a loophole, so that you've got wide sweeping fire. In fact, from here and here, they had placed cannon and crossfire. They killed a lot of the Europeans attacking. That's New Zealand wars, though, but the pa had altered. And so certainly by the time of the New Zealand wars, you had many of the Māori, not only had they adapted their pa, but they had a fair old amount of combat experience, but with that a lot of savvy and ingenuity. So we'll move into the musket wars themselves now. So the first battle, rather than the start of the musket wars, I guess, was at Moramanui. And it took place on a little beach, we now call it Bailey's Beach, just north of Dunville. And essentially, out of the north, a Ngāpuhi Taua war party was going to come down, follow the beach line down to attack the Ngāti Whātua in the Kaipara area. Ngāti Whātua got word of this, and rather than wait, they decided their strategy would be that they would go up and they would ambush the Ngāpuhi, because they knew the Ngāpuhi were going to come down, follow the beach down, and they were going to camp where this river line comes in. And so the Ngāti Whātua hid in the bush, and in the dawn, when these people had arrived and they were just setting up for a meal, next minute they launch their attack. Now the Ngāti Whātua, they only got traditional weapons. Ngāpuhi have some muskets, but the shock of the arrival of the Ngāti Whātua was enough that even though the few muskets got fired, couldn't reload them. Essentially, when one of their rangatira was killed, the Ngāpuhi break, and they're followed up by the Ngāti Whātua with some 150 of the 500 Ngāpuhi being killed. In fact, they drew a line to stop any further charge up so that they wouldn't kill even more of them. But so many dead that it was the action became the Te Kai o Te Kororo. In other words, the Feast of the Black-Backed Gulls. There were so many dead bodies left on the beach that all those big seagulls were having a go at them. Now, in the battle, Hongihika from Ngāpuhi, he lost a sister, a brother, and another relative. And this fueled his desire for utu, or revenge, for the next 20 years. So, you see these events, there's all this reciprocal. So, Hongihika himself was there, as was Kawiti, another name that comes up in the New Zealand Wars. Both escaped. But of course, they had a lot of experience by the time it came to the New Zealand Wars later. So by 1818, so a decade later, muskets are still only available in limited numbers. But as I mentioned earlier, the Ngāpuhi are starting to raid as far as the Taranaki, where even a few muskets is going to help them. So in 1820, as we know, Hongihika gets a whole lot of muskets acquired from the United Kingdom. So there's our first little battle. It's not the start of the war, but it's a portent of things to come. So this is a map again from Rod Crosby, and this just shows the scale of the Ngāti Toa heke, or migrations, their tawa, their war parties, and the battle sites. So you can see, you think that country, you think of the scale of the distances, whether it be by waka or by foot. It's pretty incredible. In fact, when I talk about him in relation to the Wellington campaign, I often refer to Ruapaha as the Alexander the Great of New Zealand, given the scale of his military travels. Now, I'm not going to cover all these battles, just four. Horowhenua in 1823, Akaroa, and Kaiapoi, two South Island battles. All of these are undertaken by Ngāti Toa. And then finally, I'll have a look at a couple of the displaced Taranaki tribes who went initially with Ngāti Toa but eventually went off to the Chatham Islands. Now, the reason I've selected this one is because it's near to us, right? Near to Palmia, and we drive through Levin. You have to now, I think, with the roadworks. And probably no one pays the lake much attention at all. But again, thanks Ron for the map. This stems from a Ngāti Toa migration, and they're in the company of Ngāti Kawata, Ngāti Rārua, Ngāti Tama, Ngāti Mutunga, Te Ati Awa. So there's a whole group of them are travelling down the west coast of the North Island now, from Taranaki, coming down towards, they're heading basically to Kapiti in the end, but they get as far as the Horowhenua. Now the Māopoku people who are around the Horowhenua are a bit, suddenly thousands of people are coming into our area. So anyway, they feign hospitality, they invite Taropraha and about 20 of his people, including family members, to a feast, which they hold down at Lake Papaitonga, just down here in the green circle. It all seems to be really well, but when Taropraha and his family are asleep, suddenly they get attacked by the Māopoka people. And although Taropraha himself survives, a daughter and his eldest son are both killed. So you know what is going to come. So Moapoka, they disappear. They take refuge in their... they build a pa, basically, on logs and stumps inside Lake Horowhenua. They go on there, take in all their waka. They feel quite protected. And others go in to the local tribes to get away from it all. And they think that because all the waka are in with them, they're safe. How are they going to get attacked? So what Te Rauparaha and his group do, they come up, they waka up to the entrance of the stream here, and then, and you think, as a kid I hauled some canoes up a stream once, it's not pleasant, but you imagine carrying or carting waka inland all the way from the beach to Lake Horowhenua. They arrive there in the dawn, and there's a mist on the lake. So carefully they waka themselves up to the pa and get there, and pow, they blast. The Moapoku, those that survived the initial fusillade, they're leaping in the water trying to swim ashore, but there's Ngāti Toa and others on the water to get them in the water. And those that make it to the banks, they are quickly killed off by the Ngāti Toa and others who've been waiting on the banks to ambush them as they come out of the water. So, you know, the stratagem, you know, this is what I find interesting about the musket wars is, you know, the casualties and all that sort of stuff aside, is all this sort of stuff that goes on is quite fascinating, especially, you know, to a military person. But anyway, Te Rauparaha, he managed, he achieved surprise, and he certainly achieved his aim. You know, despite all the physical demands on the warriors to haul those canoes and all the rest of it, they were definitely effective. It wasn't kind of like the end of it all for Ngāti Toa. It wasn't easy after that, but they eventually captured the Kapiti Island, as I mentioned earlier, and used that as their kind of stronghold. And once they consolidated themselves down there, Te Rauparaha started thinking about the South Island. So, just a bit of background, this is going to be about Akaroa. In 1829, Te Rauparaha launches a war party to the South Island. He conquers the area of the Sounds first, and then they head down for Kaiapoi, which is a large Ngāi-Tahu pā. And when they get there, this guy Te Pihi Kupe, who I mentioned, who went to England, got the weapons, and Te Rauparaha's uncle, he and about 20 other Ngāi-Tahu are invited into the pā to parley, to talk. All good, but then they're killed. So Te Rauparaha is furious. He kills in front of the pā any of the people they've already captured and swears to come back and get utu. But he doesn't get utu on Kaiapoi. What he does is he decides to direct it at Akaroa, because that is the pā from which the actual person who killed Te Pihi Kupe comes from. So he's got a plan. Now the difficulty is going to be, how do you get from Kapiti to Akaroa? There's no ferry anymore. Well, that thing is gone. So by happenstance, and this is one reason that Te Rauparaha selected Kapiti, because he knew that ships would pass by. Anyway, this ship, the brig Elizabeth, comes in, and a plan is hatched where for 25 tons of dressed flax, Captain Stewart and the Elizabeth will take Te Rauparaha, the Te Pihi's son, and 70 warriors all the way down to Akaroa. So as the ship comes in, the warriors hide down on the hold, and Te Rauparaha and the son, they hide in the captain's cabin. Ship comes in the harbour, local Māori come out, and they, hey, bring the chief, we want to trade in muskets and gunpowder. And this has been done before, so it's no problem. It's a couple of days later before the chief turns up with a few warriors, but he also brings his wife and his daughter. So they come out to the ship in their waka, they board up on board, hey, and the chief and wife and daughter are taken into the captain's cabin, and they are grabbed. Trap sprung, and the warriors come out of the hold. get the rest of the Ngāi Tahu who boarded the ship, and then the next morning they used the ship's boats and the waka, the Ngāi Tahu waka, to go and raid local village and the pā itself. So utu done on the man who killed Te Pihi. So quite an ambitious raid, and again Te Rauparaha has his success militarily, but he's still got to deal with that Kai Poi pā. And this little sketch map of the pā. So Te Rauparaha spends the whole of 1831 planning and gathering together a large coalition, and the operation he plans is to again go across to the top of the South Island, but break his war party into two larger groups, a group comprising primarily of Taranaki tribes, so Te Atiawa, Ngāti Tauma, Ngāti Rārua. They head down the west coast of the South Island, all the way down there, conquering as they go, about as far as present-day Hokitika, before they cross over the Alps to get to Kai Poi. So this is a grand kind of strategy that's being organised there. And meanwhile, Te Rauparaha himself leads another group down the coast towards Kai Poi. But they lose surprise simply because on the way they attack another pā, and kind of scouts find out that this big war party's coming. So thousands now of defenders from Ngāi Tahu are inside the Kai Poi pā, including a whole group of Otago-based iwi with the brethren there, who are armed with muskets, who've been visiting Akaroa. They've now come into the pā itself to swell the numbers. Te Rauparaha besieges Kai Poi pā, pretty much surrounded by swamp, as the diagram shows. But there's an area here, and this is where he starts, takes a few weeks, but they start digging sacks, trenches, towards the pā, with the aim of putting lots of cut manuka in the saps, which they're going to light up. It's going to burn up and burn the palisades down, and then you go. So that's the strategy that they adopt. So they're digging these saps, they're filling them up with manuka. Occasionally, Ngāi Tahu will send out little raiding parties, try and kill the Ngāti Toa that are in the saps and get some of the manuka out, but it's not enough. And at a point, the manuka is piled up pretty high against the defenders' palisades. And at this point, the defending chief decides on a risky strategy. Because the wind is blowing away towards the attackers, he decides they will light up the manuka themselves. And this works for a while, but there's a wind change. It's kind of no wind. And it comes back. And so suddenly, the pā is filled with smoke and embers and all that sort of stuff. The palisades collapse. So there's a massive haka done by Ngāti Toa, a huge fuselage with the muskets, and then in they go. And no one really knows the numbers that were killed in there, but lots. And the survivors who broke out in amongst all the confusion, they were pretty much hunted down quite relentlessly. And needless to say, after that, Te Rauparaha, just to really rub salt in the wound, goes around and has another go at that Akaroa pā, just to make sure, in case they didn't do it right the first time. So, highly effective. You can see them at the waka there coming down, but they're employing sapping, so engineering type things. So there's all these strategies that they've worked out and that they're using as a way to overcome pretty formidable defences in a place isolated by all that swamp. So the last one I want to look at is the Chatham Islands here. So they are 800 kilometres east of the South Island, so quite some way away. And they've been inhabited by Moriori, who've actually, they're Maori originally, have come from New Zealand and gone there, but for hundreds of years, essentially, they lived there isolated. and they've developed their own pacifist culture because they're living so close together if they have all these fights. So they don't fight. You know, maybe it's a boxing or a wrestling match and there's some blood's drawn, it's all over, argument settled. But so when the displaced Taranaki iwi, who are now have been from Taranaki down in Wellington, decide that actually they're going to go and seek refuge on the Chathams, they're not really prepared for this group that's going to come over there. So the two tribes, they get the Lord Rodney, the ship, to take them over. There's about 900 who go across in two waves, and very quickly they kill about 200 of the Moriori, and they pretty much enslave the remainder, who are then converted to crops and other things there. And, you know, here we go. The two tribes, Ngāti Tama and Ngāti Mutunga, you know, they've actually built two pā down here at Waitangi, and they're fighting each other now over the arable land. So, you know, the Ngāti Mutunga eventually prevail. Some sort of truce is worked out, and then, you know, I guess it's peace between them there, but they definitely dominated the Moriori. And so by, as I say there, by 1862, of the 2,000 original Moriori, there's only about 100 or so left alive. Yeah. So there's quite a large scale reduction, well, you know, big reduction in their numbers, and quite, I think they're still recovering from it now, but there'll be more Moriori out today. So, you know, why did they end? Probably a number of factors all contributed to them. Here's just a few. Certainly the arrival of Pākehā in greater numbers in the 1830s and 1840s. Not only that, a number of Māori were converted to Christianity, so thou shalt not kill. But also with law, they knew that utu would be killing, and killing or murder is outlawed. So there was that kind of idea of some sort of law that might regulate that. But possibly the largest factor was that muskets and gunpowder were now so widespread, it was quite difficult as an attacker or the belligerent to actually get a result. And so you combine that with the fact that there's been, you know, everyone's basically war-weary, and that slows things down a great deal, but there was quite a marked reaction then with the final rule party. So, in terms of the impact, so again, you know, a lot of battles. So we only covered 4 of 1,000, but I think you get the idea. 18 to 20,000 dead, 50,000 maybe indirectly impacted, and perhaps 30,000 either internally displaced or taken as slaves. So pretty big numbers out of a total population that's been estimated as, say, between 100 and 150,000. So that has had a huge effect there. So, you know, why are they significant then? Certainly, you know, I talked about the migration of the Ngāti Toa and a lot of the Taranaki tribes, but they weren't the only ones. So there was that, a lot of that displacement. But going back to the example of the Ngāmotu, so once all the Taranaki had left, when those Pākehā settlers arrived in 1839, 1840, the land appeared to be empty, depopulated. So instead of seeing hundreds of Māori around cultivating the land and being everywhere, all the power occupied, it seemed almost deserted. And moreover, those few members of Te Ate Awa and the other tribes that had been left behind, so that you could actually show that you never completely left the area and could go back to it, they, in many cases, traded off that land without the full authority for the real, the prominent rangatira who were now displaced. So you had this kind of, I won't call it confusion, but you had a situation whereby, in some cases, those who were not authorised to trade land on behalf of the bigger group were doing so. Possibly in the thought that the others weren't coming back anyway. I don't know. Some of the iwi alliances and relationships now, I guess, could be attributed back to the musket wars. Although, notably, the Waikatos came and supported the Taranakis during the Taranaki campaign of the New Zealand Wars. So, you know, even though they had fought bitterly, they were united when it came to 1860 and the first Taranaki campaign. And indeed, Taranaki iwi members fought during the Waikato Wars on the side of the Waikato as well. You know, many rangatira got nationwide reputations, so Honihiki we know about, Tarapaha, that sort of thing. And, you know, there's even Tarapaha's Kamati. You know, he was escaping from, I think it was Te Whareitoa, or maybe Ngāti Maniapoto, actually, but anyway, so there's those sort of things. So, you know, big impact, quite apart from the numbers of displaced and killed on the population itself. And also, now when looking at Waitangi settlements under the tribunal, they often take the end point of the musket wars rather than the end of the New Zealand wars as what your iwi entitlements to land, etc. were. So, for instance, Ngāti Toa, not so much Kawhia now that they are on the Kapiti side of the Wellington region, and Te Ati Awa, they were quite prominent in their, you know, around not participation, but when we had the upheavals around Parliament earlier this year, where, you know, suddenly you've got a Taranaki tribe with mana whenua, they are Te Ati Awa, who were in the Wellington area as a result of the musket wars. So, you know, that's taken as being part of the area. One of these is just one from the Waikato area. So it's very unusual to find musket war sites actually being remembered, but in this case, the tribe there, you know, they acknowledge that it's not just a significant site for them as probably the victims, but also for Ngāpuhi, who were, in this case, the attacking force. And, you know, maybe there will be some recognition of musket wars. And certainly one of Ron Crosby's arguments is that, you know, even though the New Zealand war sites are in the North Island, you know, there's some good musket wars ones that could be used as part of the history curriculum when it kicks off in New Zealand schools. Because at a point it had been left off curriculum. So books, and they're all actually in this little thingy. You won't be able to see them off to the side, but Ron Crosby's Musket Wars being one I refer to, but there's those ones there that are handy references if you want to know more. But also, and it's just as well with the school curriculum coming along, but there are a number of sites online as well if you're interested, including the bottom one by the Kiwi Codger there. This guy, he flies a UAV around like Moramanui, and then he suddenly marks it on the screen that you can see what's going on. He gives a pretty good explanation. So there's some material out there which I hope will appeal particularly to the younger generation if they're interested in the history program. So, you know, it was a large-scale, wide-ranging series of campaigns, if you like, a long-running war, the longest in New Zealand's history, and large numbers of casualties. I guess the question is, you know, why shouldn't it, or isn't it perhaps a little bit more remembered than the New Zealand wars or the Boer War or anything else? I mean, it's a long way. There's a lot less information about it, I guess, which would contribute to it. But I think they were significant, and hopefully this little snapshot has professional knowledge of the musket wars, and maybe provided the impetus to do a little bit of reading on the subject yourself, or visit Lake Horrocław. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. Happy to take questions.
Sure, there must be some questions out there.
What was the? Do you know what the approximate European population was at that stage?
No, but it's in the thousand or so if you're lucky, and that, you know, you've got odd settlements. So Dickie Barrett, 10 or 11 of them. Thomas whaling station, probably 4 or 5 of them. Ships coming and going doing the whaling. The sealers as far south as Fobo Strait, so very, very small numbers. And the reason that Ngāpuhi have managed to get the weapons and have that sort of contact is the sheer numbers, hundreds really, I guess, of Europeans that are coming through on board ship, spending a month or 6 weeks or something in the Bay of Islands, fitting out, restoring themselves, and they go back onto the whale hunting. So there's not a very large European population at that stage. The numbers really start to ramp up from 1839 with the arrival of the Tory as the survey ship, and then in quick succession, boom, 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 all those shiploads of settlers are starting to arrive. You can imagine a line of ships all the way back to London, pretty much. They're all on their way down, and the Maori don't know they're coming. In fact, neither did the Europeans. It's only the New Zealand company that really knows the true picture there. Yeah. Very small, and so just to lead on from that, and so even then, the settlers that arrive, you know, they don't know how to use weapons. They're not versed in weaponry. Perhaps unlike farmers and New Zealanders today, many of whom have handled weapons, it wasn't the case for most settlers. So they arrive in a situation where they're pretty much unarmed. And so there's not a hell of a lot they can do.
Other questions?
What was before the start of the Maori musket wars, what was the driving force between the intertribal warfare?
It's going to be over land or better land for a start, resources. So as the numbers come up,
was slavery part of it?
I don't think slavery was a big thing in the early days. There would have been some taken, but mainly it was around just resources or a slight between one person and another that caused a bit of a stoush. Those sort of things. There was a I can't remember the name of the ship, but there was a European ship that came to port, took a number of women forcibly on board, and then ditched them at another place down, further down in the Bay of Plenty. The Maori then got the women and didn't treat them well, and so the tribes came. So there was sometimes there's a bit of a cause in there, but mainly it was going to be over resources or slight, and then it would be sorted out with traditional kind of warfare and not too big a deal, and they'd quickly settle down again. Maybe a little bit of displacement, but nothing like this huge movement of war parties. But there was something, and I don't know what it was, that caused the original Maori who went to the Chathams, and you know, we now know as Moriori. There was something, I'm not sure what it was.
That so, what year was that when we went?
Roughly. Yeah. We know that the Te Atiawa went in 1835, but the Maori that went to the Chathams, you know, had been there for about 300 years at least on their own without any contact from the mainland. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure though of what the cause was there. So, when Maori first arrived, of course, there was lots of moas and all that sort of thing, but maybe as food stocks dwindled and Moa had gone. The kumara wasn't a particularly nutritious or food. It wouldn't grow in the southern areas, or coal couldn't grow up in the Uruweras or certainly around Tūwharitoa's area up in the volcanic plateau. So you probably find food resources and arguments over that were a lot of the cause of strife.
I mean, don't forget that the count so far from the 1500s to the 1800s, there were 7,500 pa constructed of varying sizes. So that's 7,500, the majority of the North Island. That's a heck of a lot. Mm-hmm. And so you had all the little wee iwi and you know, various subgroups and families occupying these pā of various shapes and sizes. And, you know, typical human beings, if somebody went pinched a pig or, you know, shot somebody else's kuru or whatever, or inflicted wounds on somebody and they died, so utu would be back in. So there was a heck of a lot going on. And in fact, when you actually think about the overall aspect, and it's good now that we can talk about this history, but when you think about everything up to the beginning of the 1800s and what went on, where it was sort of hand-to-hand combat for utu or other reasons, but then from that period, 1807 onwards, the 1830s, you had the muskets coming in. And then it was another 30-odd years before the land wars. And so that 30 years of colonisation, and because of these peaceable colonials, brought in all the British infantry regiments supported by other arms and the Royal Navy. And all that escalated over that 30-year war, so that as soon as, you know, the 1960s came right through to 1872, with the land wars, you know, you had this huge escalation of combat in New Zealand. So there's an incredible history there that, you know, we just haven't even touched.
And some say that the musket wars ended in 1845, because that's when the Northern War started, and that was when the opposition were now the settlers and the British regiments had arrived, and that became the new focus. So perhaps that's why. You know, there's lots of conjecture there.
Was there a relationship between the Maori fighting on the Pākehā side and previous conflicts in the Maori Wars?
Yes.
So
there's a good point. So despite what I said earlier about the Waikatos siding with Taranaki tribes and vice versa during the New Zealand Wars, sometimes the positions taken during the musket wars caused certain tribes to ally themselves perhaps with the Imperials and the British, you know, because of that earlier experience.
Don't forget, a lot of them actually did go to England, you know, like Te Pihi Kupe and Onieka and so on. And so after spending 6 to 9 weeks on a ship going to England, and then meeting up with members of the royal family and sort of learning English and so on, and coming back with their stock of muskets and ammunition and so on, powder, you know, there was quite a big, strong relationship established during those various journeys. It wasn't jumping on a plane in 26 hours, you know, arriving in London and then, you know.
What about Trans-Tasman? Because Sydney was Sydney a big source?
Yeah, so in fact, muskets pretty much origined in Birmingham to London, London to New South Wales, and there ships would stock up on the muskets and the gunpowder, take them across to New Zealand, get the pigs, flax, potatoes, bring them back, sell them, get more weapons in there. You had, in fact, I wrote it down, I should have actually mentioned this point. I found only this morning someone had done a PhD on the weapon and the gunpowder trade, but I wrote down a figure. Let's see if I can find it. Yeah. 18,000 muskets imported into New Zealand in the 1830s, mainly through New South Wales, Sydney, from Britain, and primarily from the Birmingham area. So, you know, you had a whole supply line of muskets that were basically being used as a currency in creating, you know, that trade.
Don't forget the shipping around the country of all shapes and sizes, with all the whaling, sealers, and other trading going on. Any other questions?
Yeah, some of those muskets were, what I understand, would have been trade muskets and not of the same quality as military.
No, initially they were just tower muskets, sort of trade things. The barrels and the mechanisms were pretty awful. They weren't very accurate, but Maori still learned to do quite well with them. And at Ngā Motu, there's a guy there who, from the Waikatos, who's almost a sniper. He's perched up on a rock firing into the back of the pā trying to pick people off. It's not really until later on that they're getting more accurate military-grade weapons, and certainly during the New Zealand Wars they managed to acquire those, either through capturing them off the British or later on from the colonials. But early on the muskets weren't much good at all. They were just cheap and nasty.
What was the sort of shape of the whole matter? Was it sort of, did it start slowly and then build up before muskets came into the country and then tail off?
Yeah, pretty much.
Ran out of people, so yeah, sort of peak in the middle?
Yeah, and I think you'll find that that chart that shows the thing there, and, you know, you have the big arrival of, you know, 1818 and 1820-ish, all the way through to about 1840, you know, it's got quite an active phase, and then it just tails off. Yeah.
Some other references that I've added to Peter's list. I mentioned about the engineer history, one by the Spade. We devoted the first two chapters quite deliberately. The first chapter tracks the Māori history as a military engineer from the 1500s to the 1800s. And then chapter two talks about the development of military engineering in New Zealand from 1840 through to about 1910. In this, particularly the research describing the different types of pa has gone into in quite some detail here, because that is the origin of not only the musket wars, but certainly the New Zealand wars. And so there's quite a lot of detail in that one. A couple of other ones that I know that we've referred to from time to time, there's also James Cowan's books, as well as James Bellich. There's a bit of competition, isn't there, Peter, going on about, but they're very good, those two volumes. There's this little one that I mentioned last time when Peter spoke, the little one of Matthew Wright's talking about the New Zealand Wars, but that only starts at 1845. It doesn't get into the musket wars. But the two that I do want to allude you to are produced by Peter Cook, who's our author of One by the Spade. Particular publications, Forts and Works is one that he produces bi-monthly directly out of what they call the Defence of New Zealand group. It's a research, military history research group. And there's some very detailed articles in here on some of the very early periods of development in New Zealand. And then, of course, there's the New Zealand Military History Society, who produced the Volunteers little booklet a couple of times a year. And so these are references written by military historians that we've got out in the library. And, of course, our old Bible, 1869 report to the British Parliament about the land wars, whilst this is 1861 onwards. This is, volume 17 out of that particular collection that we've got out at the Engineer Museum. All of these publications are actually up on our website. They've all been scanned and digitised. And in the back of this one, I won't put my gloves on and open it up, but are all the maps from those early 1863 through 1865, showing exactly what Peter was talking about in terms of the development of the geometry of a pa, from one battle to the next. Those that survived would come back, have a hooey, work out what worked against what weapons, and then they'd redesign them and change the geometry. And you can see this development over a very short period of 3 to 4 years, where the Māori were absolutely superb engineers. They had it really sussed. And so as the colonials would bring more Brits out, and more cannon and more small arms weapons and so on, they'd work out how to combat them. And it's a very interesting study in those particular references. So will you just please join me again with a round of thanks for Peter for another excellent presentation.